1940. Chapter 1. The Originals. On the afternoon of the 10th of November 1940, Captain Pat Reed gazed up at the castle on the cliff and experienced the combination of admiration and anxiety its builders had intended. "We saw looming above us our future prison," he later wrote. "Beautiful, serene, majestic, and yet forbidding enough to make our hearts sink. A sight to make the bravest quail." Quailing was not in Pat Reed's nature. Indeed, he saw faint-heartedness of any sort as a moral failing, and refused to countenance it in himself or anyone else. An officer in the Royal Army Service Corps, he had been captured in May, one of thousands of soldiers unable to get away after the fall of France. Initially held in Laufen Castle in Bavaria, he had immediately supervised the digging of a tunnel from the basement to a small shed outside the prison walls, and then made a break for the Yugoslavian border with five other officers. They were on the run for 5 days before they were caught and sent to Colditz, a new camp for incorrigible prisoners, and therefore a place for which Reed was amply qualified. Born in India to an Irish father, at 29 years old, Reed was a natural contrarian and a born exhibitionist, a most dependable ally and, as an opponent, obstinate and insufferable. He had once climbed the rugby posts during an England-Ireland international at Twickenham to plant a bunch of shamrocks at the top. Described as a thick-set, wavy-haired fellow with a mischievous look in his eyes by one fellow inmate, Reed spoke and wrote exclusively in the argot of the boys' own paper, the British Boys' magazine dedicated to heroic public school exploits. He displayed at all times a relentless, chirpy optimism. With a strong sense of his own place in the drama, Reed would become the first and most extensive chronicler of Colditz. He hated the place on sight and spent most of the rest of his life thinking and writing about it. The British officers, later known as the Laufen Six, were marched across the moat and then under a second stone archway, whose oaken doors closed ominously behind us with the clanging of heavy iron bars in true medieval fashion. In peacetime, Reed had been a civil engineer, and he cast a professional eye over the battlements. The ground fell away in a sheer precipice on three sides, below terraces festooned in barbed wire. As the day faded, the castle walls were lit by a blaze of searchlights. The nearest city was Leipzig, 23 miles to the northwest. The closest border to a country outside Nazi control was 400 miles away. Escape, Reed reflected, would be a formidable proposition. The little group was marched under another gated arch and into the inner courtyard. Only the sound of their boots ringing on the cobbles broke the silence. It was, wrote Reed, an unspeakably grisly place. Colditz Castle stands on a hilltop 150 feet above the Mulde River, a tributary of the Elbe, in the east of what is now Germany. Before it became a German province in the 10th century, the Serbian Slavs who inhabited the area had called it Koldjeze, meaning dark forest. The first stone of what would become a mighty fortress was laid in about 1043, and over the next millennium, it was repeatedly expanded and modified, destroyed and rebuilt by the great dynasties that tussled for power and prominence in the area. Fire, war, and pestilence changed the castle's shape over the centuries, but its purposes remained constant: to impress and oppress the ruler's subjects, demonstrate his might, frighten his enemies, and incarcerate his captives. The hereditary rulers of the region, the electors of Saxony, converted it into a hunting lodge, with a chapel and banqueting hall, and in 1523, the surrounding parkland became a game reserve encircled by high stone walls. White stags were held in a special enclosure in the park or Tiergarten before being released and hunted down. The electors kept their dowagers, turbulent relatives, and unmarried daughters within the castle walls. In the early 18th century, under Augustus II, Elector of Saxony, King of Poland, and Grand Duke of Lithuania, the Schloss was enlarged with additional fortifications and pleasure gardens, and a theatre. Augustus the Strong was a man of immense physical stamina, skilled in the sport of fox tossing, which was exactly as nasty as it sounds, and a prodigious womanizer, said to have fathered somewhere between 365 and 382 children. The castle was expanded to 700 rooms in order to house them. By the 19th century, the Saxon princes had turned their attention elsewhere, and the castle on the hill became a poorhouse, a remand home, and then a hospital for the incurably insane. The most expensive lunatic asylum in Germany, Colditz was a dumping ground for the mentally disturbed members of wealthy and notable families, including the composer Robert Schumann's son, Ludwig, who arrived, deranged, at the age of 20, and never left. By the 20th century, it had become a place of death. A vast mausoleum of freezing stone floors, drafty corridors, and hidden misery. During the First World War, it housed tuberculosis and psychiatric patients, of whom 912 died from malnutrition. Before the war, the Nazis used it as a concentration camp for communists, social democrats, and other political opponents of Hitler. More than 2,000 such undesirables were imprisoned there in a year. Some were tortured in its dank cells. After a brief period as a camp for Reich youth workers, in 1938, it became an asylum again, but this time a lethal one. 84 physically and mentally disabled people were deliberately starved to death, a testing ground for Hitler's full-scale euthanasia program. But in 1939, it became what it will always be remembered as, a camp for prisoners of war. The Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, OKW, or German Army High Command, turned Colditz into a special camp, Sonderlager, for a particular breed of captured enemy officers. Prisoners who had tried to escape from other camps, or otherwise displayed a markedly negative attitude towards Germany. These were designated Deutschfeindlich, or German unfriendly, a word that has no parallel in any other language and is virtually untranslatable. In Nazi Germany, insufficient friendliness was a crime. Being Deutschfeindlich merited a red tab on a prisoner's record, a mark of demerit in German eyes, but a distinction of note among POWs. The castle was henceforth a camp for captured officers, an Offizierslager, designated Offlag 4C. The denizens of Colditz Castle, over the centuries, had been many and varied, but almost all had this in common. They were not there out of choice. The dowagers, lunatics, Jews, virgins, tubercular patients, war prisoners, and white stags in the park had all been brought to the castle by others and could not get out. Even the bastard progeny of Augustus the Strong were trapped in this huge hilltop compound. The great castle had supposedly been built to protect the people, but it was always a projection of power. A vast, castellated giant dominating the skyline, erected to awe those living below and keep its occupants securely inside. It was either magnificent or monstrous, depending on which side of its walls you were on. The building consisted of two adjoining courtyards. The inner, older space, no bigger than a tennis court, was cobbled and surrounded by four walls 90 feet high. On the north side were the chapel and clock tower. On the west was the Saalhaus, or Great Hall, with the theatre, parcels office, and senior officers' quarters above. On the south was the prisoner's kitchen, adjoining the German quarters. The east wing was the Fürstenhaus, or Prince's House, which would accommodate the British prisoners. The sun penetrated the inner courtyard for only a few hours around noon. A single gateway led to the larger outer courtyard, which itself had only two exits. One over the dry moat leading down to the town of Colditz in the valley below, and the other through a tunnel under the barracks, sloping down towards the park and woods that had once been the gardens and hunting grounds of the mighty electors. The prisoners were contained in the inner courtyard, while the German guards, men of the 395th Defence Battalion, occupied the outer one, the garrison headquarters known as the Kommandantur. Colditz Castle looked as solid and unyielding as the rock it stood upon. In reality, it was full of holes. The colossal stone warren had been built in layers, one on another. Rooms expanded, windows opened up or filled in, corridors blocked, drains diverted and redug by men who had been dead for centuries. It was riddled with hidden compartments, abandoned attics, doors secured by medieval locks, and long-forgotten fissures. Over the next 4 years, Reed and the other inhabitants of the inner courtyard sought to exploit these openings, while those in the outer courtyard struggled, just as energetically, to plug them. A tall, sharp-faced German officer saluted crisply as the British prisoners entered the courtyard. "Good evening, my English friends," he said, in impeccable English. "You must be tired after so long a day." Leutnant Reinhold Eggers was the antithesis of Pat Reed in every possible way, being formal, self-disciplined, and humourless. As patriotic as Reed was deutschfeindlich. The two men detested one another on sight. Their meeting marked the start of a long and bitter contest. The son of a blacksmith from Brunswick, Eggers had fought at Ypres and the Somme, and finished the war, after 51 dreadful months, with an iron cross and a bullet wound in his leg. Eggers described himself as a German patriot devoted to my country. But Eggers was no Nazi, and had briefly fallen foul of the party before the war for failing to show sufficient enthusiasm for National Socialism. Already 49 years old when the Second World War started, he was called up again and, like many older soldiers, deployed in the Army Prison Service as deputy to the senior duty officer at Oflag 4C. He would go on to become the Supreme Security Chief of Colditz. A schoolteacher by profession, Eggers retained all the attributes of an old-fashioned Prussian headmaster. An orderly, fastidious disciplinarian, as brittle and stiff as a stick of chalk, but even-handed, unflappable, and insistent on good manners. He believed that a career spent educating disobedient children ideally suited him to maintaining control over the rowdiest POWs in Germany, and he applied his rules for teaching to running a prison camp. Never show any emotion. Keep smiling whatever happens. Punish disobedience with energy. A man of principle, he strongly disapproved of using violence against inmates except in self-defence. His diary and other writings offer a remarkable insight into Colditz from the German perspective. Eggers was also an ardent Anglophile, a risky enthusiasm in Nazi Germany. He made no secret of his admiration for the British countryside, courtesy, language, food, and good sportsmanship. The dissertation for his teacher's diploma was entitled The Theory and Practice of School Reform in England from Victorian Times to the Present Day. In 1932, he had organised a school exchange between the Johann Gottfried Herder Gymnasium in Halle and Cheltenham Grammar School. While Nazism was on the rise in Germany, he had spent several happy months in the Gloucestershire spa town, lapping up British culture and English beer. But the experience had left him with a warped perception of England, and he emerged with the impression that all Britons were like those he had encountered in Cheltenham: polite, interested in Germany, and incapable of unfair play. He was about to get a rude surprise. Even before the first prisoners arrived, Eggers had spotted two major flaws in the Wehrmacht's plan to create a super prison for difficult prisoners from which it would be impossible to escape. The first was the building itself. It looked daunting, to be sure, but the sheer complexity of its medieval layout made it extremely hard to render secure. "The place was impregnable," Eggers wrote, "but a more unsuitable place to hold prisoners will probably never again be chosen." The second was the nature of the inmates. Deutschfeindlich, the bad types, as Eggers put it, undesirables with established reputations as disturbers of the peace. Removing troublemakers might make the other prison camps easier to manage, but Eggers, the schoolmaster, was acutely aware that if you put all the naughtiest boys in one class, they pool their resistance, egg one another on, and soon your classroom is on fire. Every school and prison needs a rule book. And for Eggers, this was the Geneva Convention on POWs, signed by Germany and 36 other nations in 1929, laying down regulations governing the feeding, housing, and punishment of POWs. Prisoner welfare was monitored by a neutral, protecting power, initially America and then Switzerland. Under the convention, captured officers enjoyed certain privileges, including being treated with the regard due to their rank. Unlike prisoners from other ranks, who were held in a labour camp known as a Stammlager or Stalag, officers imprisoned during the Second World War could not be forced to work for the Reich. The most senior officer among them was recognised as an official intermediary between the camp authorities and the prisoners. The inmates of Colditz might have lost their freedom, but they knew their legal rights, and so did the Germans. The paramilitary SS operated the concentration camps with an inhuman disregard for international law, but in the army-run POW camps, most senior German officers saw it as a matter of soldierly pride to uphold the convention and took offence at any suggestion they were failing to do so. In the midst of an increasingly brutal war, the German army guards were still sticking to the rules. For now. "They do not resort to petty tyranny," wrote one British inmate, "but treat us, after they have taken every precaution to prevent escapes, as gentlemen who know the meaning of honour and possess a gentleman's dignity." As he looked around the courtyard for the first time, Pat Reed felt he had entered some ghostly ruin. And sure enough, as his eyes grew accustomed to the gloom, eerily pale faces began to appear at the upper windows. A contingent of 140 Polish officers had arrived a week earlier, and now welcomed the new prisoners with a slow rising chant. "Anglica! Anglica!" "The English! The English!" As POWs, the Poles occupied an anomalous position. Some 420,000 Polish soldiers were captured by the Germans in 1939, and their country had been carved up between Germany and the Soviet Union. In German eyes, they were not protected by the convention. "Poland no longer exists," Polish officers were told upon arrival in Colditz. "It is only due to the magnanimity of the Führer that you are benefiting temporarily from the privileges accorded to prisoners of war of the other belligerent powers. You should be grateful." The Poles did not feel grateful. Most felt only visceral loathing for the Germans, which they did little to disguise. The Polish officer contingent was led by General Tadeusz Pyszko, who had been sent to Colditz for refusing to shake the proffered hand of a camp commandant. "The Poles seethed with hatred of us," wrote Eggers. Reed and his five companions were marched up a narrow staircase and locked into an attic room, where they found three more inmates: Canadian RAF officers who had been shot down over Germany the previous April and escaped from another camp, only to be swiftly recaptured, comprehensively beaten up, and taken to Colditz. The British were settling into their new quarters when they heard a scratching at the door, which swung open to reveal four smiling Polish officers carrying several large bottles of beer. It had taken the Poles less than a week to work out that the ancient locks on the castle's internal doors could be opened with ease using a couple of instruments that looked like button hooks. A small party now took place, conducted in fractured English with snatches of French and German, the founding ceremony of an enduring Anglo-Polish alliance in Colditz. As he fell asleep on a straw-stuffed mattress in a narrow wooden bunk, Reed reflected that the Poles must have opened at least five locks to reach the British quarters from their own billet on the other side of the courtyard. If they could get from one place to another through locked doors, well, so could we. The first few weeks in Colditz resembled another phony war, similar to the period of tense inaction just after war itself was officially declared, as the different nationalities, the guards and the prisoners, carefully assessed one another and their new shared home. Compared with some of their previous camps, the castle seemed almost comfortable, despite the peeling walls and pervasive smell of mould. One new inmate felt he had joined a sort of club. The British and Canadian contingent was moved to permanent quarters in the East Wing, with flushing lavatories, showers, spasmodic hot water, electric light, a stove, and a long hall used as a mess room for eating and recreation. They could circulate in the courtyard during daylight, but the rest of the huge castle was strictly off-limits. The food produced by the German kitchen down in the courtyard was unappetizing. Ersatz acorn coffee, thin soups and black bread. But it was edible. As officers, the prisoners were theoretically entitled to pay, which came in the form of camp money to be spent in the prison shop or canteen on cigarettes, razor blades, blankets, and, at least initially, weak beer. Three times a day, the prisoners were assembled for a roll call, or appel, in the courtyard. Having formed up in ranks by nation, they were counted, laboriously recounted, addressed by the Germans if there was anything worth saying, and then dismissed. The first roll call was at 8 a.m. and the last at 9 p.m., shortly before lights out, when the electricity was cut off, the staircases were locked, and the courtyard was shut off. The 200-strong German guard contingent outnumbered the inmates, but over the first few weeks, prisoner numbers steadily increased. More British and Polish officers, a handful of Belgians, and a growing contingent of Frenchmen. Each nation was assigned to separate quarters. At first, the prisoners of different nations were kept forcibly apart, but the Germans soon realized this was going to be impossible, and so the inmates mixed and mingled in the courtyard during the day and covertly at night. For many, this was their first prolonged exposure to people of different nationalities and cultures. National rivalries persisted, but some were rather surprised to discover how much they had in common. "The Poles and the French are excellent fellows," observed one British inmate. "They are all of the difficult prisoner type, but difficult prisoners make interesting prison companions." The Blitzkrieg invasions of Poland and Western Europe were so swift and successful, they had created an unanticipated problem for the German war machine. A vast army of prisoners to be housed, fed, and, in the case of other ranks, put to work in the service of Hitler's Reich. More than 1.8 million Frenchmen were made captive during the Battle of France between May and June 1940, around 10% of the entire adult male population. The rescue operation at Dunkirk had ferried 300,000 soldiers of the cornered British Expeditionary Force across the Channel to safety, but for every seven men who escaped, one was left behind as a prisoner. Thousands more would be captured in June after the Anglo-French force surrendered at Saint-Valery. By the end of 1940, some 2,000 British officers and at least 39,000 other ranks were in the bag, including many from the British Dominions, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. As the war progressed, these would be supplemented by prisoners shot down or otherwise captured in battle. The first Colditz prisoners were the cream of their nation's professional armed forces. New graduates from Sandhurst and the École Spéciale Militaire de Saint-Cyr, as well as veterans of the First World War. Marching off to war in 1939, they had been told to expect a swift victory. None had seriously contemplated the possibility of being captured, let alone herded into Germany and locked up indefinitely in a dismal fortress. Laying down their lives for king and country was one thing. Risking and losing their liberty was quite another. And most were entirely unprepared for captivity. Christmas 1940 was a strange, oddly peaceful time. Cut off from the outside world, the prisoners knew nothing of the progress of the wider war. There were no letters from home, no orders from high command, and no sense of the future. Sealed up behind medieval walls, they found their perception of time began to elongate. The war might end tomorrow, or never. They might live here for years. They might grow old here, or die here. After the adrenaline of combat, the trauma of capture, and the uncertainty of being transferred here from other camps, Colditz seemed a place apart, almost surreal. A fairy tale castle floating high above the town. The optimists predicted they would soon be released. The restless ones were not prepared to wait for a liberation that might never come. The realists settled in for the long haul. The dank corridors were suffused with the smell of musty decay. At night, rats could be heard scuttling over attic floorboards. Most of the castle remained empty and locked, occupied only by the ghosts of former inmates. The walls looked as if they had smallpox. But on a clear night, when the snow-clad countryside rolled away into the distance and the sound of church bells floated up from the village below, the place was serene and almost beautiful. The Poles laid on a Christmas dinner of sorts and staged a puppet show of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which ended, unlike the traditional version of the fairy tale, with the glorious restoration of the Polish nation and a rousing rendition of the Polish national anthem. The Germans distributed wine and beer to the prisoners. Eggers was delighted to discover his Christmas rations included a pound of real coffee beans. The last of it I saw for years, he would note. As he sipped his Christmas coffee, Lieutenant Eggers jotted down his own reports, as if assessing the latest intake of pupils at the start of a new school year. The Polish officers were top in morale at the end of that year, 1940, although they had been in our hands for over 15 months. The French were still solemn after their defeat. The British were digging themselves in. They were also exploring how to dig themselves out.